Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You may have heard about the orca whale in Northwest waters grieving for her child. She's been carrying her dead calf on her back for more than a week now. Should humans follow that whale, help her, leave her alone? We're going to get the latest from a researcher who's out on a boat in the Georgia Strait right now. That's coming up in just a few minutes. First, our top story today, the Seattle Mariners just lost one, and I'm not talking about last night's game. There's a proposal to spend King County tax money on the Mariners Stadium, up to $190 million, and one of the sponsors just dropped her support. County Councilor Jean Cole Wells joins us now. Welcome, Councilor.
Hi, good morning.
You had co-sponsored a plan to spend up to $190 million on Safeco Field Stadium upkeep. Now you want to drastically reduce that number and instead spend the money on affordable housing. What made you switch?
Well, it's a very complicated item. But we have before us a plan that the executive, County Council Executive Dow Constantine, transmitted to the council that would provide a path forward for spending taxpayer funds on the arts and culture, on affordable housing and plans for homelessness, as well as for tourism promotion. And part of that was to include about $179 to $190 million for maintenance and upkeep of Safeco Field, a publicly owned facility. I thought that sounded good. 37.5% to housing and 37.5% to arts and culture. The catch is, though, we have a real crisis on our hands now. I really listen to people. I listen to constituents. I listen to groups all over the county and the region. And we have a crisis that's been announced. We all know it, and I think we need to put more money into that. The state law allows for putting 37.5% minimum. It could be more into housing. And so I'm saying let's shift it a bit, still leaving funds for tourism, still leaving funds for Safeco Field maintenance, not enhancements. And I think this is a good balanced plan.
What did you learn about our affordable housing situation that you didn't know when you were talking about $180, $190 million for Safeco Field?
It's like a giant puzzle. And for me, investing in a public stadium maintenance is a good thing to do, but I don't think we need to do it at the level that the Mariners want. We get revenue from people attending Mariners games and staying at hotels and shopping in stores and eating in restaurants. We also need to put more money into tourism, but we have a crisis on our hands, and I concluded that we need to put more money into the housing category.
The Mariners agreed to stay in Seattle in part in return for basic stadium maintenance. As you said, it's a publicly owned field. The King County Executive Dow Constantine told me that is what the $190-ish million would pay for, is that maintenance.
Just for the basic systems, not for the amenities that have been bandied about.
Not for luxury boxes.
Not for luxury boxes or brew pubs or anything like that. For steel and air conditioning and wiring and plumbing, that sort of thing that a normal landlord would need to maintain in their building.
So, Councilor, when you talk now about much less money, $25 million, are you proposing giving the Mariners less than the county promised?
Well, it's not a promise. It's up to the county council. The county executive proposes. We actually vote and have that in place. So what we're doing is saying, no, I think it's fine to put in money for maintenance. But looking at the list submitted by the Mariners had some enhancements. And that, I think, they can come up with the money themselves.
What was an enhancement that wasn't just maintenance? What was an enhancement?
Such as new club boxes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that means luxury suites or not. That is the type of example. And we had our council staff scrutinize the list, and it came to $24 million for really needed maintenance items. And I agree completely with the executive on that. But the other items beyond $24 million were ones, such as I said, to enhance, to increase, which I would like to have, believe me. But we have an obligation to our taxpayers now to address the homelessness and the too costly housing where it's forcing people out.
Well, how would this money go to address the affordable housing situation or the homeless situation? Specifically, what would the money go to?
So that will be determined, but the general categories that's allowed in state law and as County Executive Constantine transmitted to us would go for workforce housing, transit-oriented developments so that there could be affordable housing placed at transit centers, which would be very helpful, and for programs to address keeping youth out of homelessness.
This is County Councilor Jean Cole Wells. Why give the Baroners any of this hotel motel tax money? Why not tell them the county's done giving public money to sports teams?
Well, I was an enthusiastic supporter of the Mariners stadium when I was in the state Senate, and I believe there's a really terrific economic impact, both directly as well as indirectly, by having the Mariners here, by having the Seahawks here. The revenue that comes into the state, to the county, to the city, directly but as well as indirectly, when people come here and they spend money on restaurants and hotels and so forth. So it's a good investment, and it helps enrich our culture. I think the Mariners are great. I think the Seahawks are great. I think the Seattle Storm is great. And we all benefit from that. And so many people love going to the games.
Okay, Counselor,
I want to make sure that continues, too.
Just a couple more questions. You drafted a new sexual harassment policy for the King County Council. And I wonder, does your decision have anything to do with the Seattle Times investigation that found three Mariners executives accused of inappropriate workplace behavior, including three settlements with women?
I'm very disturbed by all the reports that are coming out with the Me Too movement. Part of my rationale and intention on the new ordinance for requiring that there be policies, anti-harassment discrimination policies, including on sexual harassment, but not totally, is for the betterment of all of our King County workforce and, as a result, everybody around here. That was not a factor in my decision yesterday to pull the plug on my being a sponsor and to come up with, I think it's a really rational, strong option to use in coming up with an agreement by the King County Council.
Okay.
It's very disappointing. I'll put it that way.
Counselor,
very disappointing.
Back to the Mariners then. They have said they're not threatening to leave Seattle, but they also said they won't sign a new lease on Safeco Field if the county doesn't spend enough on upkeep. Is there any chance the Mariners would leave town over this?
I can't see it, and I certainly do not want that to happen. Okay. And I will fight to make sure that doesn't happen, but I don't believe it will. And if we really look at what are necessary maintenance needs, we should help fund those. We definitely should. I look at the list, and our council staff analyze the list, and we see $24 million for the absolute essentials.
Okay.
Now, the bottom line is this is not over yet. The next public hearing on this will be August 29th,
mm-hmm.
and we will have opportunities to hear more from the public. We won't vote on it then. It'll go to the full council, and a vote will be in September, so we can come up with the best plan. Mine is an option, and I'm willing to negotiate with other council members.
Okay.
And the executive.
Negotiations to come, and as you said,
yes.
Another public hearing 4 weeks from now, Wednesday, August 29th. King County
okay.
Council Member Jean Cole
Great.
Wells, thank you for
thank
this.
Thank you very much.
And finally, if the baseball season ended today, just a little update, the Mariners would be in the playoffs as a wild card team. They're clinging to a little one-game lead over the Oakland A's. Back in a moment. Glad to have you along here on KUOW's The Record. We are live tweeting the show at KUOW. Choppy waters are making it challenging for researchers to track that grieving orca mother known as Tahlequah. The whale delivered her baby last Tuesday, but the calf died a half an hour later, and Tahlequah has carried her calf hundreds of miles on her back in the past 9 days. And the world has been captivated by this vigil. My guest is the Soundwatch coordinator at the Whale Museum in Friday Harbor. Taylor Shedd is on a boat in the Strait of Georgia, tracking the whale. Welcome, Taylor.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good, thank you. What about you? What's the scene where you are? Can you look around and tell me what you see?
Yeah, so we're sitting in about 15 knots of breeze here, kind of headed into the waves. We are with whales here. We have members of J and L Pod with us today, but they're very spread out over the strait here. So it's kind of a slow go. They're spread out in groups of one, twos, and threes. So we're slowly idling around, checking kind of each group that we see to see if we can find a J35 here.
And you're what, west, northwest of Vancouver Island?
Yeah, so the Strait of Georgia is kind of between Vancouver and the San Juan Islands.
Why are you tracking these orcas?
Well, Soundwatch is out here. This is our 25th year, and we're with the whales basically every day in the summer anyways. We do boater education and act as a research platform. We are following J35 just to monitor her health and make sure that she's okay and give kind of an extra zone of protection around her from private boaters. And, you know, the commercial industry has been very cooperative, and they've decided voluntarily to stay away from this group and let her have extra space so that we're just not adding stress to her.
J35 is the mother orca I'm calling Tahlequah. How is she doing?
Yes.
How is she doing?
Well, we haven't seen her yet today, but yesterday we left her at about 8:30 p.m. and she was still carrying her calf. At the time, she was traveling by herself, but with her family members close by, and she was doing all right. You know, she was keeping up pace with all the other whales. She was actually towards the front of the group, which is good to see. So makes me think that, you know, all in all, she's doing all right. You know, she can still swim at pace and is keeping up with the rest of her family.
What do you make of her now for 9 days or so carrying this dead calf, orca calf, on her back?
I don't even know what to make of it at this point. You know, it is just so sad and hard to see. And I just wish that we could do more for her right now. But yeah, people keep asking me when I think she'll drop it. And at this point, you know, I don't really know. I don't know what's going through her mind. I don't know what she's thinking or how long she intends to go along with it.
This is an unusual length for this kind of what people are calling a morning vigil, right? It's unusual.
Yeah, there have been southern residents in the past that have carried deceased calves or stillborn calves before. One whale comes to mind, L82, carried her calf for a day or two. So it's not the first time that we're seeing this. It's the first time that we're seeing it at this length. Doesn't mean that it hasn't happened before. These whales spend lots of time out in the ocean, especially in the winter where we don't see them. So, you know, this could be normal, and this is just the first time that we're seeing it here in our inland waters.
What is that like for you, Taylor, to watch Tahlequah grieving like that?
It's hard. I mean, I first saw these whales when I was 9 years old as just a little kid who was super stoked to see his first whale. And now kind of, you know, starting my career as a marine biologist, you know, there's like the science in me, but there's also still that little kid who loves whales. And, you know, it's sad. It's super sad to see her grieving like this. And I can't even pretend to imagine what she must be going through. And then, you know, for me personally, every day, you know, it is kind of a relief to see her and know that she is still here and see that she's doing well and, you know, swimming and all that sort of stuff, too. So, you know, it's just this roller coaster of emotions.
This is Taylor Shedd on a boat in the Strait of Georgia tracking the J&L pods of southern resident orca whales. And we're talking about Tahlequah, who's grieving. That's how we talk about what this animal is going through, that she's mourning her like a dead child. But if this were a human child's death, would we watch like this? Is there a time we should look away and let her be alone?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm not really sure what the answer is at this point. You know, we're monitoring her to make sure that she is okay. And we're kind of trying to mitigate risk away from her, such as other boats. And, you know, in the instance that she does decide to leave this calf, you know, we're going to make super good notes of where it is and what time and the tide, so that if it washes up on shore, we can get it into the right hands of the people who can hopefully figure out maybe why this calf died, so we don't let it happen again. But yeah, at what point do we stop? I'm not really sure. You know, we're monitoring her from a very safe distance. We don't think that we're adding any extra stress to her. You know, we're obviously not following her through the night or anything. And, you know, as I said, we still haven't seen her yet today. So, you know, these are wild whales. They do what they want. So there is a chance that we don't see her today and she just spends all day by herself. So, you know, I don't really know the answer to that question at this point. We're kind of taking it day by day.
Is her grief, is this this ritual, this vigil, is that putting Tahlequah in, or her pod, in some kind of danger?
I don't know if danger is the right word, but it's adding this extra stress to them. They already have these other risks that they're facing: low prey availability, contamination, pollution, vessel noise and traffic. You know, so they have a lot on their plate already, and to just lose a member of their family and carry it around and be reminded of it every single day has just got to be hard. And, you know, we're trying to figure out if she's being provisioned or if she's feeding at all, because this now would be day 9 that maybe she hasn't had anything to eat. So we're starting to be concerned maybe for her health, and, you know, we're hoping that she's okay. We have seen her drop the calf a few times and do some surface behaviors. We saw her breach and a behavior we call cartwheeling, where she throws her tail in the air. But then after those instances, we saw her take a deep dive, obviously, to go retrieve the calf again. So that gives us a little bit of hope that she does have the ability to drop the calf and do some other behaviors. I haven't really seen her display any foraging behaviors, chasing fish herself. We have seen her family members and lots of other whales display some of those behaviors. So hopefully they're catching fish and provisioning her with some food.
So then, Taylor, if she might be under duress, stress, maybe not feeding, is there any point at which conservationists would intervene to protect her and end this vigil?
No one has talked about ever taking this calf away from her. I think this is something that she needs to go through and her family needs to go through. You know, we're not trying to take this calf away from her. We're letting, you know, it take its course. Hang on, I really got to answer the radio.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I ran the radio issue.
J50 was off to your port side.
I don't know how long Taylor's going to be answering that radio call. I think we got a lot of information. Taylor Shedd on a boat, a research boat, in the Strait of Georgia, tracking the JNL pods, tracking J35, the orca known as Tahlequah, and keeping other boats away from her as she carries her, as far as we know, still carrying her dead baby calf on her back, but possibly at some cost to her and the pod. It's arresting. It's sad, and it maybe is stressful for that orca. So we'll follow it along for you here on KUOW Seattle. We are going to be right back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW, Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Governor Jay Inslee declared a state of emergency yesterday due to wildfires. That move means the National Guard will be deployed to help battle the fires in central and eastern Washington. What does that look like? Today, 2 National Guard Black Hawk helicopters arrived in Spokane, and 100 members of the Guard are making their way right now to northeast Washington. But a thing about those 100 people being sent into basically an inferno, they are not daily firefighters. They are bankers and construction workers. Some work at the Fred Meyer. What is it like to work with firefighters with almost no experience? Here to answer that question is Aaron Schmidt, Fire Operations Chief at the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
100 people doing something important, but with training, but not really experience. How does that work?
Well, you know, so we have a tremendous asset in Washington with the Guard men and women, the soldiers, and you know we've recognized that for many years. We put on preseason training. We put them through the wildland firefighter basic firefighter training, which is the same training we put our own folks through. And again, like you mentioned, these folks aren't firefighters by trade, and but they are a part of a big organization. They are professionals, and they come out to our fires with enthusiasm and a willingness to help and participate and protect communities in Washington. And the enthusiasm is always very high with these folks.
You've got a compressed amount of time. What do you focus on when you're trying to train up somebody with little or no experience in fighting fires?
Well, I think the single most important thing with fire, no matter what you're doing, is safety. And really, in a compressed amount of time, we teach these folks how to fight fire safely, how to pay attention and what to look for as the indicators of changing conditions on the fire line in the fire environment. Weather is probably one of the most dynamic challenges in the fire environment, and so we do spend a reasonable amount of time on fire weather, fire behavior, and safety practices that are commensurate with the tactics we teach them in actually suppressing the fire.
Does an example come to mind? Something that, look, you, I don't expect you to know this, but you need to know this, so listen. What's an example?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things, and especially with the weather patterns we're seeing in the last couple of weeks, we're seeing lightning activity. And one of the things that's very dangerous with lightning activity is when a thundercell comes into the fire area, you've got indrafts and outdrafts, and that thundercell itself is really creating its own kind of micro weather. And so you can be working on a fire and have active lightning in the area, and as that thundercell moves over, you know really to expect the unexpected. You know you're going to have increased winds. So we teach them what thundercells look like, how they develop, and if nothing else, to be able to expect the unexpected when those are in the environment.
I understand you have a demonstration where you soak a fire suit in repellent and strike a match.
Well, that was something that was kind of interesting, and again, we're taking folks that come from different walks of life and different experience sets, and we noticed that when these folks are deployed perhaps overseas or in a jungle environment, they will actually use bug repellent not only on their skin, but they'll cover their uniforms in it too, to ensure they have a good saturation of to keep out critters. We did notice they were doing that on a fire last year, and the problem with that is insect repellent's flammable. And so to demonstrate the point, we actually took a set of firefighter clothing that's made out of Nomex, which is, you know, fire-resistant material. We did saturate it in insect repellent and lit on fire as it burst into flames. We wanted to demonstrate that this isn't the environment to be saturating your clothes in insect repellent.
Okay, good examples of a lot to learn. And then finally, on the flip side, Aaron, what is the big advantage of the National Guard being called in here?
Well, I think the big advantage of the Guard is they're used to coming together, and even though it might not be wildland fire specific, they're used to going to places of chaos, and they're used to going into situations that have significant safety considerations. They're a fantastic group to work with. They're happy to help the local communities in Washington, and again, they're plentiful.
Governor Jay Inslee calling on the National Guard to help fight wildfires in central and eastern Washington. And we've been talking with Aaron Schmidt, Fire Operations Chief of the Department of Natural Resources, helping to get these folks up to speed. Aaron, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Same to you. So, as we said, Governor Inslee declaring the state of emergency gives Washington State some help in fighting fires. But are we doing the right thing when we fight wildfires? My next guest is an environmental journalist. He just wrote a piece in Harper's Magazine titled Combustion Engines that takes a look at the bigger picture here. Richard Manning, thanks for joining us on KOW.
Well, thanks for having me.
What about the way we approach and fight wildfires? What are we getting wrong?
Well, we're focusing all the attention on the immediate situation. In other words, we're saying we can handle fires, we can put them out, we can send in the National Guard and helicopters and deal with it. When in fact, what we should be doing is reacting well in advance of the fires. And what we should have done 30 years ago is do something about global warming. Global warming is really what's causing these fires today, and they're making them unmanageable. We cannot deal with them. And then more specifically, now what we should be doing is stopping people from building houses in the woods. It's about that simple. We spend something like $6 billion a year in this country putting wildfires out, and 95% of that money is spent on 15% of the land where houses are built. In other words, we're spending our money and risking the lives of National Guards people like you just talked to protect houses.
How would we prevent people from building houses in the woods? How would you define the woods?
Well, it's well-defined, actually, in fire science. They have an unmanageable name for it called the WUI, which means the Wildland-Urban Interface. That just means houses in the woods. But it's all mapped out in every state in the West, and it's very clear where it is. And every county knows where it is. What they won't do is do the zoning required to prevent people from building in those areas. And with the wildfires becoming much, much more intense, orders of magnitude more intense, we can no longer hold on to these areas just as we can no longer hold on to hurricane-prone areas like Houston. And so we're going to have to back off, and that's how we do it.
So if it's a matter of costs and benefits, let's talk about the other side of the ledger. I mean, do you understand, Richard, what people get out of the questionable decision of living in wild and wildish wooded areas?
Sure, I do, and they could do so wisely, though. And one of the things to do is understand not all of that area has to be off limits, but some of it does. And if you do build there, you have to do things like plan exit routes so you can get out of there. Most people are really killed trying to escape a fire. And then build a house in a way that's fireproof. So you use a steel roof instead of a cedar shake roof, for instance. All of those things can be mandated in zoning, and in the end would do things like prevent the loss of firefighters' lives.
Why do we build cedar shake roofs in the woods instead of metal roofs?
Well, people got away with it for a long time, 30 years, and so the habits die hard. And in pre-global warming times, you could get away with that kind of stupid decision or get away with it for about 20 years. But now we no longer can talk in those terms because the wildfires are so prevalent that you can't get away with stupidity any longer.
Do you want people who are already on their land to be, I don't know, forced out, bought out by the government and moved off their land?
Or the alternative could be burned out, and that's happening a lot more than we'd like to admit. And so that sort of thing is happening by default these days simply because we're unable to manage the fires. But no, more likely what we would do is take a look at people who have already built in those places and say, no, you may need to make these changes. And we've done that in a lot of places in the West. And sometimes the changes amount to maybe $5,000, which is what somebody would spend on their kitchen countertops these days. Why not do that to prevent your house from burning down?
And are you advocating for less firefighting, less fire suppression?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I don't have to advocate for it. We have done a lot less in a lot of places in the West. We've had a wilderness policy in place now for 30, 40 years in wilderness areas of allowing fires to resume their natural role on the landscape. And in those areas, fires have gotten much smaller. We spend almost no money on them, and they have achieved enormous ecological advantage by restoring those landscapes. We need to do things that look like that in the interface where the houses are.
By the way, you write about how houses can become what you call ladder fuel for other houses that you would think are in safe places.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting phenomenon, and it first emerged in a lot of the California fires. And I know fire scientists with whole collections of photographs showing a charred remains of a house and standing next to it, green trees, actual live trees, which means the fire would burn the house down, but if not hot enough to kill the trees. So those fires spread house to house, not tree to tree. And it's pretty unfair to call them a forest fire anymore. Those are subdivision fires.
So what is the most likely change you see us making in the near future? I mean, obviously there's going to be resistance to, well, being told where you can't live, also being told what you've got to do with your property.
Yeah, it really won't matter if there's resistance. A lot of houses are going to burn down anyhow. It doesn't matter what we say about it. It is beyond our control at this point. And that's the change that has occurred in firefighter culture. If you talk to wildland firefighters, they're really pretty humble guys these days, guys and women now. And they'll tell you that, no, we really don't put these fires out anymore. The weather puts them out. And that change in culture needs to happen across the board. We understand it. But I hesitate to talk about that in some ways because that implies that this is the new normal. This is what we have to adjust to. When in fact, I think it's going to get a whole lot worse. And so what we prescribe today as sensible steps will no longer be sensible steps 10 years from now, when it becomes even more unmanageable and even more catastrophic.
When you describe wild managers, land managers, changing their culture and beginning to accept that, no, it's weather that's going to put this thing out, are you saying that people who might be expecting to have someone protect their land and their property, they might be surprised to find out how much standing down there actually is?
Yeah, they really are, and someone will be angry about it. But the firefighters got that way, not by inclination. They're inclined to put a fire out, but reluctantly. And the ones I've talked to will invariably give me a story about stuffing a body bag with a teenager and saying, you know, we tried to put this one out, and one firefighter I talked to talked to something like 13 of his friends had died in fires. They got humbled by being chastised by nature, and the rest of us need to get that way as well.
So finally, Richard Manning, what do you want us to take away from your latest piece in Harper's Magazine, Combustion Engine? What's the lesson?
Well, the lesson, I think, is the instructive nature of fire for all of us now, not just those of us who live under fire. And everybody I talk to about fire now and over the course of 30 years talk in terms of, well, this is what I want. This is the way I want the landscape to be. And what we need to understand is the landscape will never be the way we want to for the rest of our lives. That's what global warming means. We are in the midst of global warming. It is incredibly catastrophic. And we are going to deal with that catastrophe from here on in. Our lives will never be the same. It doesn't matter who we are.
Richard Manning, environment journalist, author of 8 books, and his latest article on how the West manages wildfires is the cover story of this month's Harper Magazine. Richard, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
And you just heard Richard just talking about how we're going to have to deal with the catastrophe of climate change on into the future. Let's talk about what that future could be like after this break. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. And we were just talking about being in yet another summer of wildfires. Redding, California, of course, more than 175 square miles of burned. And near Yakima, kids attending summer camps have been told to leave immediately because of a fire there. You just heard from that environment journalist, Richard Manning, clearly talking about fire suppression, but mostly talking about climate change. And that's certainly what Governor Inslee went to last year when he was talking about the burning American West.
We're seeing our climate change. Climate change is ravaging our forests. The combination of beetle kill and drought and higher temperatures has made our fires, frankly, just bombs waiting to go off.
From wildfires to sea level rise to disrupted ecosystems, how will climate change change us into the future? Well, my next guest is a futurist, a science fiction writer, and by the way, the chief information officer for the city of Kirkland, Brenda Cooper. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're writing about our future in your book series, Project Earth. Your new book is just out. What does the future Northwest look like in your series?
Well, basically, at least in the books, I have two very specific ecosystems. One of them is in the city of Seacouver. Seacouver is a city that stretches from Tacoma up through Vancouver. It is connected, automated, dense. It's sort of ever-changing. It's very prosperous. There's lots and lots of people there. It's super dynamic.
Wait a minute. Seattle and Vancouver are one city. Does that mean the U.S. and Canada are no longer?
It means that cities have gotten so much power that they're able to actually be more important than national governments, at least the megacities.
And what roughly what year are we talking?
We're talking about 50 years into the future.
Okay. And why is that important, that cities are so powerful?
Well, you mentioned I work for a city. I'm really interested in smart cities and in the importance of cities. And if I look at our current political environment and I look at how important cities like San Francisco, Seattle, New York are on the political environment, that we are making a lot of the forward progress on climate change, that we are making a lot of the changes. The states are also contributing really well to these things. And so I think that there are things that cities and states are going to be able to do that the federal government really is unable to do for a variety of reasons that probably are beyond the scope of this program.
Yes. Okay. So there you have mega cities bubbled in, and meanwhile, the wilderness around.
And that plays so well into what you were just talking about. In Wilders and Keepers, the area in between the megacities has essentially been legally stripped of public ownership rights in most places. There are a few places that are allowed to survive as small cities, say Clay Ellum, but most of the areas people have actually said, hey, you need to not have people living here for a couple of reasons. One of them is this is sort of a deeper into climate change than we are now, and hopefully even beginning to get a little bit better at it future.
And what's the world looking like in that?
And the world, well, it's been through exactly the fires that Richard Manning was talking about. So a lot of this land is burned. It's being restructured, re-put together. There are wilders out there on the land working to help rebuild wild populations. Existing forests that didn't burn or areas that didn't burn are being pretty heavily protected, both by robotics and by people. And then, of course, there are illegal people out there on that land that really wish the world was the way it used to be. So that produces a little bit of the tension in the novel series.
Why haven't those people learned the lesson you want us to learn from climate change?
Why do we have climate change deniers today? I mean, I just think there are people who just don't want to admit these things because they're inconvenient.
This is fiction, Brenda, but you call this a plausible future. That's kind of the zone you operate in. So how could your future world flow from what we are doing now? What's some examples?
One thing is I have high-speed transportation all up and down the West Coast, and we're using Hyperloops, which Elon Musk has been talking about. And I understood there's a number of other people that are talking about how do we get high-speed transportation among our economic centers here. There are a lot of trends and movements of people into cities where cities are growing at a fairly fast rate, both in becoming more dense and becoming larger. And I've extrapolated this. I think with climate change, more and more people are going to want to be in here. You're far less likely in Bellevue to be overcome by a wildfire, for example, than you are in Chelan. I think that cities provide safety, economic security, lots of opportunities for people. And I've been following Forterra's work, and what they do is to work to protect land and to also densify and make better cities. And I think that that's an interesting thing that we're going to need to begin doing.
Brenda Cooper's new book, Keepers, is book two in her Project Earth series. And you can tell listening to her, this is not just apocalyptic. You're painting a future that, like today, has good ideas and good intentions and old arguments and, right? You know, what's the core of that?
The future is going to be at least as complex as the present. It might even be more complex than the present. And so I don't like particularly to read or to write books or stories that really take one position, because I really think the world is far more complex than that. And as a futurist, I really like to explore the various things that might happen. And we're going to have people with multiple religions, multiple belief systems, multiple political beliefs, multiple hopes and dreams. And they're all going to be competing, hopefully well and happily together to, you know, to make a better world. And I think it's going to be complex.
And as it plays out in the lives of the sisters who you're following in your book, What is that main argument about? What is that? Let's boil it down to a couple different worldviews. What are we fighting over?
One of the things we're fighting over is some of the people who are with the sister who is out in the wildlands. Is she lands with some people who really, really want to have more legal rights around land and small farm ownership and things like that than they're able to have. And so they're saying, hey, we really don't want things to be the way that they are. And this conflicts the sister who's out there working with them, because it's not her job to help them break the laws, but instead it's her job to help enforce the laws that are there in her position as a wilder. The sister who is back in the city, her primary conflicts really are in a place that big and that diverse. How do you decide what you want to be and what you want to become, and how do you become helpful and useful? And then she's also, of course, trying to support her sister who is out in the wild.
And cities are in domes?
Seacouver is in a weather dome, so it's not domed as hard as, say, Stephen King's Dome book. It's not something you could walk up and hit. But there is there's a need to keep significant storm events and things away from the city. So there are fields and energies and things that are designed to help keep that from happening.
There is a lot of hope in your stories. Where do you find hope? Because we've spent many minutes talking about a grieving orca who's dealing with, you know, loss of her food and pollution and the noise of boats. And then we're talking about the West burning and climate change. And you're finding hope where, Brenda?
I share the worry about all of those things. I've been following the orca. This was a great show to listen to. But I believe in humanity. I believe that I constantly meet other people who want to make the world a better place. I meet far more people who want to contribute, who want to help, who want their families to be healthy and happy. And I believe that we're capable of doing the growing up that we need to do as a society if we're going to be able to survive the next 50 years.
How are we going to agree on what growing up is and what doing the right thing is?
You don't have to completely agree. I mean, if I even talk to people who are within my circles, which I'm going to admit are a little bit more liberal, they don't all agree. But there's a tendency to want to be clean, be neat, be honest, you know, be decent. I really think that people don't have to agree completely on what's good. What you have to agree, I think, is on what you don't want. For example, I think we're going to have to agree that we don't want a future that is soaked in oil and gas. Okay,
but yeah, fossil fuels are a thing of the past by now in your book, right?
Oh,
50 years from now.
Yeah. In fact, I've assumed a future where they don't really have to worry that much about power, because solar power is practically infinite. So I actually don't even deal very much with, hey, we have to recharge this, or what are we going to run the vehicle on? Because what are we going to run our robotics on? There's a lot of robotics in these books, because I really think we're going to have figured that out by then. And so I think there's a lot of positive technologies. This is another place that I find hope. When I talk to young entrepreneurs, I talk to people starting companies, I talk to millennials, a lot of them have a lot of really great ideas, and they're trying to bring technology to bear on making changes and creating better things by finding things we may want to do that are related to or may use new technology. We're also seeing social changes. I'm in a world where, yeah, we have two cars, but most of my millennial friends, they have zero. You know, so we're already beginning to see, I think, a lot of the changes that need to be made. Uber and Lyft and self-driving cars, a lot of these things are going to help us a lot with some of the issues that we really are struggling with as a society.
Who has the power in this 50 years on world, and who doesn't have the power? We haven't done away with oppression and tribalism and injustice, I assume. So who's got the? Who do you imagine having the power? And not.
Cities are still democratic, and the people who run the cities have a lot of the power. There is still a federal government, but it has less power than the megacities. The megacities have also created sort of a coalition so that they work on things that they may need to work on together, similar to the way that the major cities all up and down the West Coast have political coalitions where they work on some things in many similar ways. There are poor. In this world, we do have basic income, so people are not homeless and starving. You know, the basic level, you know, the lowest level of basic income basically just meets the lower Maslow's hierarchy needs. And people are still required to work because I made the decision that probably basic income with no give back from people was not a good idea. So what I have them doing is perhaps working in the gardens in the city, picking up trash, doing a variety of other things in trade for their living to whatever they're capable of doing. You know, a lot of these are details that maybe even don't show up in the book, but they show up in my notes so that I could make the book right.
Yeah, what do they call that? The book? The deep story or whatever, right? The whole world that you've created.
Right. You do a lot more world building than you're able to get into the story.
World building, yeah. By the way, again, this is Brenda Cooper, a science fiction writer, and her latest book in her Project Earth series is Keepers. And I described you as a futurist. How do you qualify to be a futurist? What are the credentials? What are your futurist credentials, Brenda?
Mine are medium strong. There's a lot of different kinds of futurist credentials. So there are people who are like the head futurist for Intel, and I probably would not get that job. But I've been studying with Glenn Heemstra, who's a local futurist, quite a bit. I've done speaking and working with futurist.com. I have talked to a number of people. Really, I think a lot of us are futurists. Most science fiction writers are at some level a futurist. I think you probably are too. You're people who are widely read, who are interested in the future, who talk about how to make it a better future and focus on that and are willing to talk about that in public venues like this, I think, are futurists at a very real level.
And you're chief information officer for the city of Kirkland. Does that, and that affects your work? You were saying you see cities as being super important.
I do. First of all, I see local government a lot very firsthand. And at least in Kirkland, local government works, which is really pretty cool because I'm not certain our federal government is working on very many levels at all right now. And I think the local government can make a big difference. I think even in a megacity, you're still dealing with some level of locality that you're not dealing with on a federal level. People are still moving in the same physical places. And because I do technology for the city, I'm interested in and exposed to a lot of the thinking about how do you make cities smart in the future. So C. Coover, in this book series, a lot of things are automated, a lot of things are run with connected systems. There's a lot of knowledge and information. If somebody, you know, has a medical emergency on the side of the street, somebody is able to see that and come and quickly help them.
But are you being too hopeful, Brenda, that technology is not just going to get harnessed by the powerful and used so people who have can keep what they have? I mean, that's the present that I see that I don't know how it doesn't get carried into your C. Coover of the future.
Well, I still have hackers, and I still have people who come in and would actually like to destroy the cities because they'd like to destroy the centers of power so that they can have the world that they wanted a little bit more. So I do still have nefarious bad guys or bad people who are into doing the wrong things. And I have to imagine, when I think about our state of technology, think about the Facebook events, for example, Facebook just found some things that they removed that they hadn't done or even been thinking about before the last election. Technology is very new. Social media is very new. And I think we and the people who are running these companies are all together learning about the dangers. And I have to imagine we'll be able to figure out how to take care of at least some of them. Undoubtedly not all of them. I mean, this isn't, you know, a perfect world. It isn't always happy. Everyone isn't fulfilled. In fact, in the opening of the first book, the two sisters' parents kill themselves because they don't have a way of feeling connected in this large city. They're basically depressed. You know, so essentially, it's not a perfect world. It does have its black and its dark spots. It has its difficult spots. But I do believe that one of science fiction's things to do, things that matter, is to help paint or show us a way that we might move forward into a positive future.
That's Brenda Cooper, science fiction writer, thinker about the future, author of 8 books. Her latest book is Keepers, second book in the Project Earth series. And when she's not writing, she's chief information officer for the city of Kirkland. Brenda, thanks for helping us.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. The show's produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, Casey Martin, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. I hope to talk to you tomorrow.